Hello and welcome to the Disney Magic Hour, episode number 43. On this week's show, we are going to review 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Sitting around the table, to my left is Melissa. Say hello, Melissa.
Hello, Melissa.
To her left is Scott. Say hello, Scott.
Hello, Scott.
Across from me is Brian. Say hello, Brian.
Hello, Brian.
And via Skype, we have Ryan. Say hello, Ryan.
Hello, Ryan.
Hello, Pete. And say hello, Pogo. Nothing compares, no worries. Did you know that off the day with that I'm a girl in you? Yellow tree,
ain't true. Nothing compares, no worries. That was No Worries. You can find that video and more over at youtube.com/pogo,
his music at soundcloud.com/pogomix. And his website is pogomix.net. We are lastgenpodcast.com. Find us on Twitter for this show at Diz Magic Hour Pod. That's D-I-S Magic Hour Pod. On Facebook, you can find us, our group, if you search for Disney Magic Hour. And on iTunes, if you head on over there and give a 5-star review, we will read it live on the air. And if you head on over to Google Play, we are also located there in the podcast section if you search for Disney Magic Hour. And of course, you can find all of our audio over at soundcloud.com/Disney Magic Hour Podcast. And I want to start right off the bat by welcoming back our friend Ryan Wilson, who is joining us for I think one of his favorite movies and mine. How you doing, man?
I'm doing all right. Yeah, it's definitely up my list.
Yeah, I knew when we were working together the schedule of, you know, when we could fit this in, when we're going to fit that in. You had a lot of traveling to do, and yeah. I was like, no, we'll work it out that you come back for this one specifically.
Yeah, it was one of the things that, like, okay, I want to do this. I will find a way to do this if it, you know, come hell or high water.
And actually, where can everyone find you at the Main Street Gazette?
They can find me at mainstgazette.com. That's the blog, and Main ST Gazette on Instagram. I'm on Facebook, Twitter, all the good places.
Nice and clean. Nice and clean. So we actually had a couple of news things that one particular news thing that we wanted to talk about today. And I believe you wrote an article on that earlier today, Ryan, correct?
Basically, I stole what Disney Parks blog put up because that was all anyone had. And it was kind of buried in an article. And I was like, this right here needs to happen. So,
so what's going on over there now?
So with the Flying Fish remodel, they've taken out the ice cream shop over there, and they're going to be opening a new lounge called Abracadab Bar.
Yep.
Try saying it 3 times fast, and nobody's going to get there. But apparently, according to the story there that WDI has put out, is it's going to be this turn-of-the-century lounge where all the magicians went and hung out after their shows, and they would try to one-up each other, whether it was creating cocktails or their magic tricks. Until like one night 70 years ago where they all just vanished and it sat vacant forever after that. And so now that, you know, Disney's come back, they're going to open it back up. There's going to be tricks, you know, that have been left around, old pieces of curiosities. So it sounds like it's going to be this really great kind of, you know, magician's bar for the layman.
Now, this is cool because, I mean, I remember downtown Disney used to have the magic shop over on the West End.
Right.
And I actually remember buying a bunch of stuff there. But even more importantly, this is a nice connection to what used to be on Main Street.
Right. Yeah. You had the House of Magic, which was the place where I can remember as a kid going and buying the little, you know, $1.50 magic trick that I was sure I could trick everyone with. But and with the curiosity, like, I almost feel like it has that Adventurers Club kind of feel, like, okay, this is these pieces from far off places that are, you know, part of our illusions that they've built into the story there.
I feel like they're doing that a lot. Like, a lot of the things that they've been opening have kind of like the Adventurers Club feel, but not 100%. But they're still like, don't worry, we know you guys loved it. We're kind of bringing elements of it.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things they're like, okay, everyone loved this, but we're just going to take it and take bits and pieces and throw it at the Polynesian and throw it at Adventureland and throw it over at downtown or Disney Springs now. And they're trying to give everyone pieces. So I guess maybe to thin out the herd a little bit and get everyone someplace that way not everyone's, you know, bum rushing one single destination.
Yeah, which hopefully for Trader Sam's that thins out the crowd a little bit because inside is not very big.
No.
See, no, but we've kind of avoided Trader Sam's during the weekend. We've only gone during the week. Yeah. Ryan, have you gone there on the weekends? How crazy is it to try to get inside and sit down?
I've done it like once on a weekend, and it was, I mean, you show up at 4 o'clock and there's a line, you know, for an hour to get inside. And so it's not even worth it.
Oh, wow.
I tend to do like a Thursday or Wednesday, something like that. Cause it's easy to get in, easy to get out, and you don't have any problems.
Do you think they'll ever revisit just the base idea of the Adventurers Club, or is that just kind of gone to the wind by this point?
I think it's the Skipper Canteen is the model. They're gonna, you know, because you have some of it in other parks with like Colonel Hathi's has some of it at Tokyo Disneyland. I think that's where you're gonna see it. You're gonna see it like in this quick service kind of thing. That's gonna be where the adventure pieces are taken, and then everything else is just gonna be how they tie into that the SEA in all the other parks and all the other resorts.
I dig it. I'm looking forward to this Abracadabra. That sounds interesting. I don't know. Everything that they've been building over in Springs has, I think, been really cool.
Yeah, definitely. And they just seem to really be like theming the heck out of everything. Yeah.
You know, even that's the new really town awesome. Center looks really nice.
Yeah, it's just, I don't know. I'm really excited with all the stuff they're doing.
Yeah, yeah, Ryan, how did you get? Did you get a glass bottle from Disney Springs?
Yeah, so they have them at both World of Disney is where I got that one, but they also have them over at the Co-op. And just there's just shelves of them, and like they're like $12 a piece for these glass bottles that are the same ones like when you walk into Morimoto's that go up that spiral chandelier piece.
Oh, okay, great. Oh, well, there's $12 gone.
Right. It was like, oh, really, $12? Yeah, that's gonna go home. That's good.
All right. Very, very cool. All right. So yeah, I'm looking forward to that. Sounds
definitely.
Like it's gonna be fun.
100%.
Now we had a question on our page for the Disney Magic Hour on Facebook that we wanted to kind of go over semi quickly because God knows we could really go deep into this discussion, but then it would be a whole episode. Joshua Garcia put forward, he was asking, because he had a conversation about it with his family around the dinner table, what would you be willing to pay for if Disney offered a lifetime pass to Walt Disney World? Now, look, in the realm of reality, this isn't reality. This is just, you know, an exercise in what would you be willing to put forward in one chunk for a lifetime pass to Walt Disney World? Who actually has an answer to this? Who came up with a number?
I came up with a roundabout number.
What's your roundabout number?
I was thinking, well, what's an annual pass now? $600-something, right?
I believe so,
well,
yeah.
Just let's just say 600. I'm thinking 10 years worth of an annual pass, maybe $6,000, between $6,000 and $8,000, maybe.
Okay.
And that's with no blackout dates, I'll assume.
Yeah, I mean, if they want to blackout, like, July and August, I probably would be fine because I don't want to melt, so I'd be all right with that, but with no blackout dates.
Ryan, what about you? Did you have a number that you were able to come to on this?
Yeah, so I kind of, and it's one of those figures that I'm like, yeah, great, I'll never afford that, but I was thinking along the lines of, so cast members get, at the 20 years, after 20 years, they get their pass that allows them to come in any day of the year with three people. And they can do it every day of the year, like no longer tied to however many times it is a year, whether it's like 10, 12, something like that. So I was like, okay, so 20 years is kind of that mark. So I was thinking like an annual pass for like 20 years, like that rate kind of, because they can get up to four people, but they've also put in 20 years with the company. So somewhere around a 20-year mark of what it would cost for like an annual pass. So what, 15 to 20, somewhere in that range.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Melissa,
what
do you got?
I was guesstimating like about 10,000, at least to kind of get yourself in the door.
Scott?
Yeah, I was around the same thing, 10, 15.
Now, what if they offered a monthly payment? Would that make this door easier to jump through?
Oh, sure. I mean,
yeah,
I wish
if you
they
could
offered,
finance it, yeah.
I wish they offered a monthly payment for the regular annual pass. Well, I really
they
wish
do,
they did.
They do if you're a Florida
for locals
resident.
And stuff, yeah. But I really wish they had something like that because it would make it much easier than having to fork it all over at once.
I think that they can't do that though, because then people would just go for their trip and then never show up again. It would have to be like very legally binding that they have to pay up.
I'm sure they could do like if you don't pay it for, if you don't pay it within 30 days of your thing, your card gets deactivated, or I'm sure there's ways around that they could figure out to do it.
Right. I think it would have to be one of those things where it was almost a year by year kind of thing for the up until you pay it off, and if you don't pay up an annual pass basically rate for that year, they send you off to creditors.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they've got it.
Or even like, I mean, I know for the
DVC?
For the locals, it's they have to do a 1-day ticket, I believe, is what they have to pay up front, and then they pay monthly. Even if they did, you have to pay half the annual pass.
It's something like that, you know, with Universal like that, Studios, too. You have to pay a portion, a percentage up front,
yeah,
and then the rest is put upon the meal plan, upon a monthly plan. I would say it would be probably 10 to 15 grand.
Yeah, I was going low. I would maybe the stomach 6 to 8, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's got to be higher.
But with the amount, I mean, if they offered it, with the amount that you know it would go up in those 20 years, you right. would be saving so much money in the long run.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Which is why they wouldn't do it, because they know you're just going to get it every year.
They can handle it. I mean, the same way they handle like the DVC and stuff. If you don't pay that, it goes away. Like, you can't use it. You can't book resorts. Like, you can't, you know, so I'm sure they could do something like that. Like, if you don't make the, you know, your payment, they you can't book reservations.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, then after a while, then it's, if you don't pay, then they, you know, goes to default.
Just get right. shot.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what happened. They put you out on the savannah.
Tinkerbell comes to hunt you.
Yeah, I'm sure.
It's quite comfortable.
They hang you over the crocodiles without tethering you. That's what they do.
You hold on for as long as you can.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And then good luck.
I'd see you guys want to move into our film of the week.
Sure. Yeah.
All right. So let's talk a little bit first about some trivia and whatnot and the history behind 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Released on December 23rd, 1954, this is actually one of the lengthier films that we've ever seen.
Yeah, definitely.
Coming in at 2 hours and 7 minutes. You know, we've been used to the hour and 15 max almost mm-hmm. animated, except Fantasia. That would be the exception to the rule. Rolling in at a budget of $5 million, which for a live action and the amount that they do in the film is, I think, kind of shockingly low. It did get a box office return of $28.2 million, so that is a bona fide hit.
Yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things I love the most about this film is who directed it. It's Richard Fleischer, who also directed Fantastic Voyage, Dr. Dolittle, Tora, 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 and Soylent Green, which is, I mean, mm-hmm. those are some classic staple films. And even more so is his father, who's Max Fleischer, who, as a Superman fan, made the greatest... I'll even say it above the animated series, even though it goes better into pathos. My favorite version of Superman in animated form, which was the old 40s cartoons, and a rival of Walt Disney. Mm-hmm. So to see his son come over, Ryan, correct me if I'm wrong, didn't this bring up an interesting, almost like the son, Richard, thought there would be a conflict on this?
He did. And he went and talked to Walt and was like, "Do you know who I am? Like, you understand who my father is?" He's like, "Yes, but I think you're the right guy for the picture." And he went and talked to his dad and was like, "Is this going to be a problem?" And he goes, "No, I think it's a great opportunity. And you should tell Walt that he got the best director available." So, yeah, I think Richard was really more nervous about it than either, you know, Walt or his father were.
Yeah, and actually, because Richard wound up working for Walt, Max Fleischer kind of buried the hatchet and, like, became mm-hmm. friendly with him. But kind of going along with what we were saying last week, this is going to be a little odd segue, but when Walt was talking to Richard about, you know, why he wanted him to direct it, Walt's quote to him was, "Well, I saw The Happy Time, which featured Bobby Driscoll,
okay.
one of our contract players. If anybody can make an actor out of that kid, he's got to be a good director."
Oh, wow.
So
okay.
tying into our, you know, he grew up with Peter Pan and blah, blah, blah. So he, you know, Walt saw The Happy Time, which was in 1952, right before Peter Pan. So he said, "Walt, you got that kid to act well. You got to have something now."
Yeah, Ryan, just to give you a bet, we were saying how we were genuinely surprised with Driscoll's really impressive voice work in Peter Pan, because in the live action films, it's very standard bad kid acting.
Yeah, and even if you watch like the old Disneyland shows when he was on like as guest spots, it is amazing what they got out of him.
Yeah, so I thought that was really, really cool. And then going a little bit forward, it did actually win a pair of Academy Awards. It won for Best Art Direction. And it won for Best Special Effects, who actually one of the people who went up to accept the award was John Hench. Surprisingly, though, when it says art direction, Harper Goff is not included in that but I don't understand how.
He's uncredited as far as I found.
He didn't have his card basically at the time. And so he was, and so the Academy wouldn't give him the award. It went to his assistant.
Yeah, because if I remember correctly, he actually has. Oh, that's what it says in the credits. It says production developed by Hopper Goff, which is a very unofficial title for art producer. You know,
yeah,
art producer.
Yeah, that's a little vague.
So yeah, but I mean, but he is the man behind the look, which you can kind of point at and say this is, you know, almost the realm of steampunk with the way that he created the look of the Nautilus. And I mean, this is very much his film, I think, more as much as anybody's.
It definitely. I mean, it was the movie. Walt hired him in to make a true life adventure, to storyboard a true life adventure out of this footage they had from the ocean and all these sea creatures. And he came back and said, yeah, that idea is cute. I think we should do 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and just use this footage, you know, in our scenes.
And didn't they, there was one particular shots when they're under the sea with the shark. There were some unscripted moments in that, weren't there? Because it's a shark.
Yeah, yeah, it was a nurse shark who got really intrigued by what they were doing, and they had all the, you know, the safety divers around trying to get it to go away, and it did just kind of swim right through. You know, they obviously played it up a little bit more in the movie, but it was such a compelling shot that they were able to capture that they were like, yeah, we're going to go ahead and just use that.
That also, I mean, there's a similar thing that happens in, I want to say it was Thunderball for James Bond. There's a scene where they're underwater and a door opens and a shark basically flies right by Connery. And that was not supposed to happen. So his reaction of, oh my God, like moving out of the way was 100% genuine.
Oh, wow.
But of course, back in those days, you just kept rolling.
Yeah.
You know, this is the days of Ben-Hur when a man died and they were like, yes, we will keep that in the film.
Yeah.
You know, right. It was seen almost as a badge of honor, actually, for a stuntman to die on film. That you had to keep, not a badge of honor, but you had to keep that in the film.
Right.
You know, they wouldn't cut away. Like, now you would never see that.
Yeah.
You know, like the Brandon Lee thing that went wrong with the Crow was cut out.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
If that was back in the 60s and the 50s or possibly even the 70s, it would have stayed in there 100%. The climactic squid battle, I think, is really interesting to talk about. And you know, we'll get to that when we talk about the film. But it's interesting because that's not what they shot.
No, not at all.
Yeah, Brian, do you know the story behind that?
Well, they shot it in the daytime, and they said this isn't working, and because the squid itself was a life size puppet.
Yeah,
so,
and it looked terrible.
And it looked terrible
in
the light.
If you could see it in the light, it would look terrible.
It would look terrible. So they reshot it in like during a storm.
Yeah, that was actually Walt who was on set.
Yeah, that was
during that whole thing, and Fleischer was nervous about it as well. And so they changed it up and had it in the storm, so that way they could hide a lot of the effects. And
you know, that must have been...
It still looks pretty good.
It does. I was really amazed at how good it looked. And, you know, Walt must have really felt that it didn't, because I'm sure that cost a lot more money to have to reshoot that.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's credit to him for doing that. Other people might have just been like, yeah, no, it's all right, leave that in there.
If that original scene stays the way that it is, I think that this film is not something that is looked upon very favorably.
No.
It becomes Condor Man.
Oh, my God. Wow.
But I did notice in that scene, I could still see the strings in one part. But
was that because you were looking for it?
No.
Oh, okay.
I just
was asking, yeah.
Yeah, but no, that was a good question, actually.
But do you know the mechanical effects guy who did the squid? He also worked on Jaws.
Really?
Yeah, Richard A. Matty. He worked on Mary Poppins, Absent-Minded Professor, and Jaws. But
all
I figured
films
you would
sharks
like that.
In them.
Yep.
big shark
all
films.
All sea creatures.
That's interesting, because I wonder if he was... because, you know, one of them sunk.
Yeah.
That's like the first one was the one that sunk all the way down. Ryan, do you want to talk about The Living Seas a little bit and its connection that it used to have to this film?
So yeah, so the old Living Seas, the Q, had quite a bit of the piece, like you had a model of the Nautilus that they had used. There was one of the full suits, and as you walked through the Q, there were, you know, cut glass pieces where you could see like diagrams of the Nautilus, and that was, you know, the old way of exploring the sea, and, you know, the old futuristic way, as it were, of exploring the sea. And then you go through your film of the seas, and then you get on your hydrolator. And, you know, you shake around in your elevator for a few minutes.
There is a part of me that kind of likes that one. I'm not one of those people who look back on things very much, but I did like that entrance a whole lot. I remember that. But now they have that replica of the Nautilus, I want to say that's on display now in One Man's Dream, as long as One Man's Dream is
as long as it's still there.
Current and there.
Yeah,
because I know that that's not going to be there very long.
And where else do they have the Nautilus?
They have it in the Haunted Mansion in Disneyland. Oh, no, I'm sorry. They have the pipe organ.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Yeah, they actually, in 69, Captain Nemo's pipe organ, which was on display in Disneyland, was redressed and now is in the ballroom of Disneyland's Haunted Mansion. Is that still accurate, Ryan?
Yes. It's still the redress. And then they made a copy of it for Florida, and they made a copy of it for Tokyo as well, I believe.
Oh, my God. I've got to go there. What were you going to say, though, Melissa?
One of the Nautilus ships from the Walt Disney World attraction is in Castaway Key. It is under the water.
If you go snorkeling, that's right.
Yep, yeah. You can go snorkel out to it.
We have not done that yet.
Because I'm not doing that. I guess I'll never see it.
Do they make you wear the outfits that Kirk Douglas?
And, no, it's just snorkeling, not scuba diving.
You know what? If that was it,
I would do that.
Then I would do it.
Yeah, me too.
I would do that.
I completely would.
That's so much cooler.
I just want to walk around in that.
That's so much cooler. Oh, something else I learned on this, because if something always stuck out to me in this film in a sense of how silly it looked, which I don't think much of any of the film looks silly, it would be Kirk Douglas playing guitar.
Oh, yeah.
In certain places.
Sea turtle shell?
Yeah.
But in this version, actually, there are parts where he's playing it, and he was taught by Hopper Goff.
Really?
Yeah.
Yep.
Which is nuts.
Harper knew how to play. He was an extraordinary. Well, he's one of the Firehouse 5+2 from Disneyland, and so that's one of the reasons. Like, if you go to his window in Disneyland and Adventureland, it's like banjo lessons by Harper Goff, and it's because he would teach people how to play guitar like around set, and one of them, was Kirk Douglas, so that he could look like he knew what he was doing in the film.
That's awesome.
I know that Kirk did come up with that hand flip on his own, though.
Did he?
Yeah, that little hand flip thing.
Did he come up with taking his shirt off multiple times for no reason other than to take his shirt off?
That man.
Oh, he looked good. I'm not going to get me wrong.
He's a brick house.
Yeah, he is. I was like, I didn't realize he was
muscular. I was like, I'm Spartacus.
Well, it's not that he was worried about his image because he didn't have anything to really do for the first 20 minutes of the film. Right. So he made them right in the scene where he comes in at the beginning, where he has the girl on each arm and gets into a fight so that he could look like, yes, I'm a ladies man and I'm macho. Like, he made them write that in so that he would. So, yeah, he did come up with the taking off his shirt.
See, there you go. I knew it.
Actually, just, you know, I'll say it now. We'll just jump ahead a little bit. But in that scene, when he is with the two women on his shoulder, he actually does call them, what is it,
Minnie?
I'm sorry, say again?
Minnie and Tessie.
Yeah, he calls them the names from the song in Whale of a Tale.
Oh.
And that went number one, if I remember correctly, Whale of a Tale. Because I remember listening to an interview with Kirk Douglas. This is when he was much older, so is, you know, a little slurred and whatnot. But he was telling a story of how when Whale of a Tale came out, he actually called Sinatra. And he said, I have a number one song now, too. I was like, you know, and that was all he cared about. What else do we got here? Ryan, you have any other little tidbits that you want to throw out before we start going into the actual film?
I'm sure I'll figure them out. I'll remember them as we go on and go, oh, yeah, right, I had this.
All
right,
cool. Let's just do that. Oh, actually, just really quick. Well, yeah, we'll talk about that when we come up to it, the interiors of the Nautilus and whatnot. So, number one, when the film starts off, we get the Buena Vista logo, which this is the first film produced under Buena Vista, which is a big mark, really, in the Disney history, getting, not away, but, you know, parting from RKO.
Yeah, it was their own production company.
Which
now.
All I think of now is, like,
RKO. Yeah, that's what I think of, too. Yeah.
Out of nowhere. I think of as Randy Orton. As we said before, you know, you get the note for a production developed by Hopper Goff, which is such a strange thing to see. But now, realizing he didn't have his card, that does make sense. That was an interesting way of getting around that. I like the opening of the film with a movie curtain theater. It actually made me think that there may have been a cue from this taken in 78 Superman by Richard Donner. Because it has a very similar opening where you enter into a large movie screen. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, well, you know, Fleischer, he did the animated cartoons and the Superman film opened the way that his son opened a film. It's a very, you know, A might lead to Z, but I don't know. I just thought of that in particular. Did anything else stick out to anybody during the opening of the film?
No, I mean, it just, you know, they had the storybook opening again.
Yeah, you know, interesting, like, for this.
I thought that was an interesting opening.
And that is the first chapter of the book, which if you've never read the book, I say read the book. A lot of it is description of the sea and description of sea animals, but you've got to kind of put yourself in the year when that came out, like in the 1800s, where this was just nuts.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
definitely.
Like, you read this, and then From the Earth to the Moon, you know, there's two stories that you read them now, maybe some parts seem a little laggish, but if you put yourself in the time of when it was released, this stuff was out of this world.
Yeah, definitely.
Like, literally, actually, in one place.
No.
What?
Under the World.
Under the World. Great. Yes.
Nailed it.
Ugh. I was waiting for you to do an Under the Sea joke. Is that going to come up later?
No.
Are you sure?
Promise.
Okay.
forget it. Because Kirk Douglas's shirt looked like Smee's shirt.
Oh,
also.
Yeah. Cool. He's a pirate.
He's piratey.
Piratey. That just popped in my head.
That's
sorry.
Such a crazy piratey shirt.
Yes, it really was.
So we basically learned that in the year of 1868, we've got some monster rumors, and we have the old drunken sailors and whatnot, and we got a toy boat, which is what I kept thinking of when I saw the initial toy boat show up. The model work in this film, though, I think holds up pretty well, given that it was made oh so long ago. They do a good job of working things to scale. If you're really, really looking, there's never anybody on the deck of any ship ever.
No.
But that's a small detail. I think it's a nitpicky detail when you're looking into what they had to work with in that day and age.
Yeah, that time, I think it holds up really well now.
Yeah, I think they pulled back far enough that if you really couldn't expect to see people on the ship.
Yeah, it was only a couple of times where I noticed it, where I was like, oh yeah, there's no one there.
It's a ghost ship.
In the middle of nowhere. So Ryan, did anything strike you from the opening with Kirk Douglas coming on and getting into the fight and all that?
You know, the one thing that stuck out to me, and I can't remember how many times I've seen this movie, but it stuck out to me when I was watching it for this, was the book, when they first go on the book, it says illustrated. It's like 20,000 Leagues Under the Seas, illustrated. And I was like, you know, they created this book and they created an illustrated version because we're going quite literally into the story. So that I always thought was like, you know, that I thought was a cool detail this time. But nothing really stands out except for, you know, the gorgeous background work that is always – that becomes a hallmark of these films.
There was one other thing that stood out to me for a funny reason. That's whenever someone gets punched and goes through a pane of glass, I immediately think of Blazing Saddles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially had that same Western-y vibe.
Yeah. He punches a man, he just flies backwards through a window. And all I can think of is, in real life, that man would be bleeding so much.
He would have been impaled by something.
Like, so badly he'd be bleeding. Scott, have you ever seen 20,000 before this viewing?
No.
This was your first shot into it.
Yeah, this was my first go.
So how's the opening for you? I mean, does it feel a little hokey, or are you fine with what's going on so far?
No, I'm fine with it. I mean, that scene we were just talking about, I actually wrote down, like, that escalated quickly. Like, it was just like, you know.
Get that man.
Some man with a trident.
Everyone.
Yeah, but no, it was, you know, it was fine for me. I mean, I have no problems with it so far.
Okay. Melissa?
Yeah, this is my first time also, and I felt like kind of lost in the beginning because I was like, am I supposed to know that blonde guy? Like, is he going to be a big part of this? Apparently, yes.
Wait, you did not know that was Kirk Douglas?
Initially, no.
But I mean, you're watching a movie. When you meet a character,
but
you're not supposed to know who he is all the time.
He was like kind of the prominent one, but not really, so I was a little lost with... Do I need to pay attention to him?
Oh, I got you.
Like,
I
that
gotcha.
Was where I was a little like, what?
Listen, he came into the scene with two girls on his arms. You got to pay attention
to him.
You
got to pay attention to that guy.
Yeah.
And then he climbs over two.
That is what you get when you let Kirk Douglas write a scene.
Exactly. And then he climbed over two horses. And, I mean.
Just to jump. On somebody else.
Sometimes you got to jump on somebody else. Sometimes you got to do it. Sometimes that's what happens. We basically cut away from there, and we meet the... I just call him Professor at this point.
Yeah, that's
I mean, his last name is
Aronnax,
which is a great name. If, like, I'm an evil wizard.
Yeah, I gotta remember that for my next character, yeah.
The evil wizard Aronnax. He's played by Paul Lucas, who I recognize from The Lady Vanishes, the old Hitchcock classic. I don't know if anyone else has ever watched that.
I never saw that one, no.
It's damn fine filmmaking. But more importantly, no insult to Mr. Paul Lucas, is Peter Lorre as a Conseil. Conseil?
Conseil.
I'm a big Peter Lorre fan, obviously. Many people would know him from Casablanca, but I absolutely love him from M. Fritz Lang's M, which is one of the most disturbing films I think ever put to cinema. And he's so great in that, it being creepy and terrifying. And he's such a little rat in Casablanca. But in this film, he's so endearing. And it shows just how good of an actor he is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I always love when I see Peter Lorre.
Yeah, because he's kind of an off-putting guy to see. Like, he looks a little strange. So for him to not come off creepy is really a great job. You know who he kind of reminds me of? And I knew it wasn't him because it was not possible to be him. Was the guy from Boardwalk Empire who Capone's, the older guy that worked Capone was working for.
Oh, I know who you're talking about.
They looked very similar. And they had like a similar, like, I don't know. They just,
the dead
just,
eye. He's the kind, dead eye. That's what it was. A little bit of a dead eye.
And just, they had the same type of, like, I just thought, I was like, oh, he looks like him. But it's definitely not him, because I know this guy died a long time ago. So it's not him.
What's your, Ryan, what's your, I mean, do you have any particular love for any of the actors that show up in this film?
Peter Lorre, from Casablanca to Maltese Falcon to, he's just, the range is incredible. And to see him, the more sympathetic character and somebody you're going to cheer for finally is great.
That's true, because he's always that guy. He's always that ratty guy. So this was a nice turn to see him in like a Disney film. It's just weird.
Yeah.
But it's cool.
This just the powerhouse of this like cast is kind of strange.
Yeah, Ryan, this was quite a cast to get for their first kind of production on their own. But by this time, Disney is swinging a pretty powerful hammer, right?
Yeah, and I think at this point, you're thinking, this is the first time they're going to do live action. You know, who wouldn't want to be a part of that either?
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah, true.
But with that still, I think the $5 million budget on this film is quite modest to what it could have been.
Especially because I don't remember the exact movies, but there were other movies of similar scope, I guess, that were a lot more at the time that were made.
Yeah, Joan of Arc, I know, was mentioned in one article.
Yeah, that was the one, Joan of Arc.
And she was like $4.6 million or something like that.
When was Cleopatra made?
I think that was later.
That was later in the 60s, right? Mm-hmm. I want to say. Because that was an insane bust of money.
Yeah.
So we have our introduction basically to all of our characters, and we find ourselves on a boat with Consul and the professor.
I love how he's like recruited by the Navy. Like the guy just shows up and is like, hey, want to come work for us? Yeah, cool.
Yeah.
It went just like that, I swear.
No, it did. The guy was like, you want to go on a boat for like 4 months?
Yeah.
Yes.
You can't get to where you're going your way, so how about our way? Try our way.
Yeah, everything worked out really well, I thought, for everyone involved. Yeah,
definitely.
But I thought something of note is that they say it's December 8th. 1968, because later on you do see the date again, and it gives you an idea of how long they were on the Nautilus.
Okay.
On their wee adventure. And the name of the ship, I don't know if anyone caught this, was the Lincoln.
Oh, no, I didn't.
And there was
a
painting of Lincoln in the background, which, I don't know, I think of Lincoln, I think of Disney. Is that wrong of me to make that connection all the time, Ryan?
No, I think you're good on that.
Okay.
You either have to think of Disney or Ken Burns, so, go with one.
And we get now, it's out of nowhere, we get a musical.
Yes, that was very strange, yes.
Yeah, it's quite the, it's like, hey, we're not going looking for this thing because it's a hoax. Meanwhile, up deck, like, everything didn't work out. I'm going to play a song for everybody. And Kirk Douglas performs Whale of a Tale.
Got a whale of a tale to tell you, lads. A whale of a tale or two about the flapping fish and the girls I've loved on nights like this with the moon above. A whale of a tale, and it's all true, I swear by my tattoo.
Strangely, this is the dumb garbage that I notice. It's a slightly quicker timing than the song that was released on a single, and that's always just because not to take as much time in the film.
Yeah.
But it's just a punch quicker. And if you watch the camera really carefully, when the more intricate finger work is going on the guitar, Kirk Douglas has his back to the camera. Because there's no way.
Not him doing that, yeah.
I mean, I don't think Hopper Goff taught him that well. Or am I wrong on that? I mean, was that actually him? Does anyone know?
Oh, I don't know. Ryan, do you know? No?
No, I don't know.
I don't believe so. I can't imagine that.
Yeah, I can't imagine that. And if it was, I don't think his back would have been turned because he would have been like, look at me.
Dead center in the camera.
That's true.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, knowing now that he,
that he shot his own, he choreographed his own action scene, yeah.
And now
I love is that with the soundtrack, you have five different versions of A Whale of a Tale on there because they're like, oh, we don't have anything else. Here's what you got.
Yeah, it's basically like that in the main theme.
yeah.
Is the two pieces of music, which we've been doing the animated film so much, like there's always this thing of, and then this song came up, and then this song came up.
Yeah.
And I wonder if there was a temptation to just make a movie musical as your first live-action feature, but then, you know, the decision was made, like, no, we're going to do live-action, and we're just going to tell a dramatic narrative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think it would have fit.
No, I don't think it would have fit, but I think it's a pretty chancy move.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's a pretty bold decision on that one. A whale of a tale or two, about the flapping fish and the girls I've loved. Nights like this with the moon above, a whale of a tale, and it's all true. I swear by my tattoo. So, but now we're going to get our first glimpse of the Nautilus. And Ryan, what can you tell us about what went into the design of the Nautilus?
Blood, sweat, and tears. No, so Harbor Goff, so there's some great pieces about it. So, you know, they have all the different models and pieces in the tank, the full size. But he wanted something that looked like it could be a sea monster. So that's why you have the metal scales. You have those dorsal kind of fins above it. The windows that look like eyeballs. He wanted to feel like it was something that, you know, a predator of the deep that they could do. And then they would end up, because they shot this in Cinescope, they only had one lens to film in Cinescope. So there were times where they actually made models that were squished up versions of the Nautilus that when they were projected at full Cinescope size, it would look like the full size Nautilus.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. So there was, so Harper Goff played a lot with his dimensions and with his angles and trying to make this look like a sea monster and not just a submarine.
One of the most iconic film designs, I think, ever.
Yeah. And Walt initially wanted a sleek design and Harper Goff was like, nope.
Well, I think I saw one of the earlier concept drawings of the Nautilus, and it was quite sleek looking.
Yeah.
And the Nautilus that we get, I want to say, was the third revision of the drawings that pretty much that I found online. I don't know if it could have been misinformation, of course, because I found it online. But that is what the Nautilus looks like.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like if Fox ever goes forward, now Fox is supposedly doing a 20,000 Leagues with Bryan Singer, which I don't know. I like Bryan Singer, but as far as like a dramatic action film goes, he's not really a very exciting visual director for me. When David Fincher was supposed to be doing that film,
that would have been something.
I was extremely excited, and now without that eye behind the camera, I still would like to see it just to see it, but my excitement in it definitely dropped off.
Yeah, a 20,000 Leagues movie, you want someone who is really good behind the camera.
Imagine the camera work that he would have done.
Yeah.
I know that Brad Pitt was also in talks to be Nemo, which, funny enough, when we get to Nemo, we'll get into that a little more. But yeah, I absolutely love this design. I would say that our first nominee for iconic shot is simply the Nautilus, you know, emerging from the water with the water rushing over it and the green eyes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Coming at us. So we get the professor and consul are stranded and they actually see the monster in the distance and the professor's like, don't care, we're going that way.
Yeah.
So he's got a death wish, I'm assuming. I don't know.
He's just really into science.
He really is. That's interesting because this is like, you could say this is a simple film, but the characters are pretty complex. Like the three characters that we're playing with, the Professor, Nemo, and Ned, are impressively complex and go through changes in the film.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Don't think this film gets enough credit for that.
No, I think it's very much more of an adult tone than anything they've ever done before. And I think maybe that puts people off from it. They don't go into it expecting that. People have never seen it before.
I don't know. We'll find out
because we
got two people right here.
Yep.
So now we're a little bit further into it. You guys have now seen the Nautilus. You were aware of what the Nautilus. I'm talking specifically to Melissa and Scott now. You guys have seen the Nautilus before, but now you're actually seeing it up close. They're on a scaled version, which I love. You know, I always love practical effects, and obviously that's what they were going to do then. It was going to be a CG because science. You know, is the feel of it still grabbing you, or are you waning interest-wise? Because, I know, Melissa, you weren't yee-haw on this film.
I don't know. I guess I didn't go into it like you guys had gone into it, you know, as, you know, maybe like a young kid or a young boy expecting, like, excitement. I don't know. For me, like, it was good, but I didn't, like, fall in love with it. But I liked the practical effects. I thought it looked really good, and I liked the fact that like it was, you know, very tangential.
Okay, tangential.
Yeah, there we go. Words.
Scott, how about you?
Yeah, I mean, this up to this point, it still has my attention. At least it doesn't end that way, but...
Okay.
Yeah, this was a sleeper for me.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
But, I mean, the Nautilus, it looked great. And like you said before, I went into it thinking of the mindset of when it came out. Because I knew things weren't going to look as good as they should. Mm-hmm. But at that time, it looked unbelievable.
Okay.
So, yeah, the Nautilus was... It looked awesome.
Okay, so Ryan, actually, when we get the two characters, Professor and Consul, they go on the ship, we sort of start to see the differences in the way that they view things. The Professor is enchanted with everything that he's seeing, while Consul is immediately aware that, like, this is dangerous.
Right. He's like, okay, this has been destroying ships. We need to get out of here. We have, you know, the Professor going through all these Victorian, you know, very parlor-esque, like, scenes with all the artwork and the scientific, you know, instruments, and he's just in awe of all of it. And then you get Ned, who comes in and it's like, oh, look, here's the kitchen. So you have all these, you know, competing interests of where, you know, where we're gonna go. And, you know, even to the point where when they are caught, you know, the Professor still isn't being physically dragged out, because he knows, you know, Consul knows that we're in trouble now.
Yeah, and in between all that, we get to see Nemo's, I guess the word, what would you call that room? The viewing room?
Yeah, observatory.
The observatory? Well, yeah, because I know it's not his quarters, because we see his quarters later.
Yeah.
So we get to look inside and we see Nemo's organ and all that stuff. And I think this room is actually a room that I've seen fashioned into home theaters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could definitely see that.
And
yeah,
it looks so great.
If
I had a dream theater to build, it would be this.
Yeah.
I absolutely love the look of it, the lushness, you know, those red, like the red velvet.
Yeah.
And just everything looks so cool to me. I just
love the design of it all.
Love the design.
Yep.
And now we have James Mason comes up. You know, they're having a little undersea burial and whatnot. And we get to meet James Mason as Nemo. Now, Nemo, classically in the book, is Indian. He's not James Mason.
Yeah, no.
That being that, I kind of think Mason does a really phenomenal job at this role. Ryan, how did you feel with James Mason as Nemo?
I think it's almost like we talked about with the Nautilus. Like, that is what you would think of when you think of the Nautilus. After this movie, to me, James Mason is what you expect when you get a Nemo character.
Yeah, and he plays it with... Okay, yeah, they don't have the race correct. But he plays it with the complexity that I enjoyed from the book of the character.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the only other version that I remember seeing of it is from The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. Mm. And that, exactly. Like, and he was, I believe, Indian in that one. But still, James Mason is the one who you see in your head when you think of Nemo.
If you ever get a chance, if you ever want to, in the limited time that you can borrow that book, The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen comic book is a different experience than the film. Basically, the film is garbage.
Yeah, no, it was.
And yes.
The book, and the book is this incredibly rich, beautiful experience to read. And the Nemo in that is my favorite character. Mm-hmm. And I remember that the way he's introduced, and it's a very famous Nemo line from the book, and I'm actually surprised it's nowhere in the film, is Alan Quatermain is basically high on everything. And Nemo captures him. And he just looks up, Quatermain looks up at Nemo and says, "Who are you?" And Nemo says, "I am no one." And then he goes out there, because Nemo in Latin means no one.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
So actually, you know, that's what he is. He's like the captain of nothing.
Of nothing,
you know, of no one. Just only himself and his people.
So we're finding no one?
We're finding no one. Yeah, that's ultimately what that movie is about. It's about finding nothing. Because also, according to the attraction, that stupid kid just runs away again at like point blank. And no one's learned any lessons.
Yeah.
I did find something interesting, though, just going back to the film. With the, you know, the introduction to the men of the ship while they're doing this, you know, at sea burial, literally. There were actually 33 men during that shot. There were 11 in front of the camera. There were 22 behind the camera.
Oh, see, that, okay, then that really clears up an issue that I think comes up immediately, because we see our three characters running around the ship and no one's to be found. But then when like three people take off their suits, everyone's in regular clothes and they're everywhere.
Yeah.
Well, I think they meant 22 as like cameramen, like behind the camera.
Oh, then never mind.
Yeah.
I think it applies too, because you know, it's so like every time we're in that portal where they're all coming up and out, it's so noisy in there. It's like that they could be forgiven for not hearing somebody else in another part of the ship.
That's yeah, true, no, too, yeah.
Yeah, I'm okay with that one. That's true. That's a good point. That's a really good point.
Well, that burial scene though, I had to laugh because when, you know, they see him standing at the window,
oh,
and
yeah,
he points and they're like, "Get him." And it's like, like, I understand where it's coming from because you can't really move that fast underwater, but it was still just funny.
No,
to see.
It is. It's funny when he raises his hands up. It's like, wait!
Yeah.
He also did that at the funeral itself. He raises his hands like very slowly, and then everyone drops down to a knee.
Yep.
Yeah.
But again, though, I would pay to jump into those outfits. Yes, Melissa.
Well, that scene itself took 8 days to shoot because they could only be submerged for 55 minutes. So I was just thinking, like, all the time and effort for that one scene. Like, it's insane.
That's filmmaking.
I know, but it's insane. They only started filming in spring, and this was out by December.
Oh, springtime. Yes? What?
Nope.
You sing? No?
Nope.
Sing
that? Later.
I do love the delivery of the line. It's very close to what's in the book. I am not what is called a civilized man.
Mm.
If you don't know much of James Mason, I would actually look at two other films in particular as well. When he was much older, the film The Verdict, directed by Sidney Lumet with Paul Newman, mm-hmm, and then a very earlier film called A Man Alone. Wow, all of a sudden I blanked on the name. I'll figure it out by the end. But it was a noir film directed by Carol Reed, who was also the director of The Third Man. And just The Odd Man. Odd Man Out. That's the name of the film. Apologize about that. Well, have it behind me. I didn't want to turn around and look. So, Ryan, how are you? I mean, like, you're a big fan of this film so far, but where are you sitting right now as you sit down and watch it again? Are you intrigued? Are you still up for everything?
I am, because now we finally have the full ensemble cast there. We have everyone. So now it's going to start being that interplay. So, you know, we've explored the Nautilus. We have all of our players. So I'm still relatively invested in what's going on.
And we get a really nice scene coming up soon when, after Nemo tests the professor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Towards his loyalty. Mm-hmm. Of, you know, either you're going to die with your friends or you're going to be a scoundrel, pretty much.
Yeah.
Right.
And the professor passes.
Yeah. Well, you know, yeah.
What do you mean?
No, that makes sense when it comes to the end of the film, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just thought of it. I just thought of that now when you said that. Yeah.
And then they have the dinner scene, which, you know, Ned is eating like an animal.
I love he's eating off the knife.
Yeah.
And he's like, you ever use a fork before?
Yeah. I really like Kirk Douglas in this film. Throughout,
yeah,
he's great. His interactions with the seal are even fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Who I'm a, what was the name?
Esmeralda.
Yeah, yeah. Esmeralda, and she's got a big N around her neck.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
For Nemo, I also love that his captain's hat has an N on it.
Yeah,
it's on the organ too. It's everywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
He labels his stuff.
He's got some ego on him.
Oh,
this
he does.
Guy. But I love the conversation, and I think it's one of the best dialogue sequences is when Nemo and the professor actually start talking after the dinner sequence where Laurie and Kirk Douglas kind of go bye-bye on the expedition, the hunting expedition.
Yeah.
This is where we get a lot of that Nemo and the professor are the same person, just opposite sides of the same card, I guess is a better way of putting
it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this, I think, Ryan, I think this is what bleeds into our main drama of the film.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's that, you know, and we get more of the details with Nemo later on, but it's that, you know, one bad day and this is what happens to you. You know, you turn your back on everything. But you do. You get this, you know, Nemo wants to show the professor everything and has some use for him. And the professor has the same use for James Mason, because he wants to bring him back to civilization.
Yeah.
Yeah, and introduce all of his, you know, right, discoveries to everyone else. And
yeah,
I like how Nemo's very cautious as to who he shares his secrets with. And, you know, I like how even now, even though you don't know much about Nemo, you understand that he's very skeptical about humanity and humanity's goodness, I guess, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, no, and I agree with the side of Nemo. You know, being the type of person that I am, when I hear Nemo put forth his argument, I have a hard time not just saying, yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, I think he has a compelling argument. I mean, Brian, are you a better person than I? I mean, when you hear his argument of, I can't give this to others because they would just morph it into a weapon.
No, and I think that gets into the moral of the story is, you know, who can be trusted with this and who should be trusted with this. He makes a completely valid argument, which is why, you know, the professor has such a tough time of trying to figure out how to twist his ideals into something that is useful to the rest of the world.
Yeah. Scott, what was that? Oh, I thought you were looking at me for a moment.
Don't look at me.
So we go out on a hunting expedition, which I will say, I think this scene goes on for a little too long.
It was a little long. Yeah.
This feels a little too long to me. I don't know why, but this also feels immensely like the book.
Okay.
Of all the sequences of the wording that's used in the book, this is extremely like the book, where the professor is telling you about all the different types of things that he is seeing firsthand and just going into great detail. This is very much like the book. So if you don't enjoy the flow of this scene, you may not enjoy the flow of the book.
Yeah.
I think it's one of those scenes where they had all that. This is where they had all that footage from the True Life Adventure they wanted to make, this undersea True Life Adventure. And they're like, yeah, we'll just cram it all in right here.
Yeah, you can tell.
Yeah, they kind of did. Yeah, because I don't think that we have another extended scene underwater. Actually, we don't have another scene underwater after this. Am I correct in thinking that?
I think with the suits? I think maybe one other scene, but it's not.
Okay.
It's not extended. I can't remember, honestly. But the one thing,
when they're doing the repairs later.
That's what it is.
The rudder and whatnot. Yeah.
The one scene that was really, it just stuck out to me. I don't know. I found it kind of creepy was when they were walking with the turtles.
Yes.
Yeah.
To their death.
Yeah. Like,
and they were holding them, and the turtles were looking away. Yeah. Exactly. I was like,
wow, this is kind of, it's kind of something here.
It struck a memory of the darkest episode that I wish I never watched of Iron Chef.
Oh no, don't say it.
You can just imagine what happened.
I was like, poor Crush.
I had the same thought watching it this time.
I thought there was a really cool little filmmaking technique used in here where it's hard to tell who's who. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, because everyone's got the heads on. But when they cut to Kirk Douglas and Laurie, because I keep feeling like I'm saying Council wrong. When they cut to Laurie and Kirk Douglas, Ned and Council, you hear the cue of the music for Whale of a Tale.
Yeah, you hear that music like a lot in different versions. But yeah, I noted that like a couple times. I was like, oh, this is playing again.
Yeah, it's a good way of just letting you know, like, okay, we're with these characters, mm-hmm. even though you might have trouble seeing their faces through these goggles. Yep. And all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, the other telltale sign you had was Nemo has like the flashlight on top of his head, on top of his helmet, and that's the only distinguishing characteristic for anybody else.
Does it send out an N?
It probably does. Like a Spidey signal with the N.
Yeah, exactly. Oh God, I hope so.
I hope so too.
That'd be so great. If that was in the new movie, I would just laugh hysterically as I fell down the entire row of seats. after they get back on the boat, I think we missed our
Little Mermaid scene.
Go ahead. Gosh. Take it away.
Because they're hunting for treasure in a treasure ship. A shark passes by the outside. Nobody notices it. And then as they're leaving with the treasure, shark attack.
All right.
You called it. You called it also, Pete.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, you did.
No, I didn't make a joke. It's a legit thing.
I'm just saying. You were going to find your Little Mermaid thing in it somewhere.
It's not my fault when it mirrors it.
Well, they couldn't have... Well, forget it. I'm getting to that now. Little Mermaid was a lot longer after.
Do they shoot the shark through the heart with an arrow?
Yes.
Am I wrong in wondering, did they actually shoot a shark?
I don't think you're...
There was no Animal Humane Society back then, right?
There wasn't. And they didn't, like, show it? Like, you didn't see the arrow hit it or anything. All you saw was the blood. But there was the
one... looked pretty convincing.
It looked pretty convincing. Huh?
Wait, wait. Was that an arrow? Because it sounded like it was like a blaster.
It was a harpoon.
It was a harpoon gun that moved at the speed of light.
I honestly...
yeah, you don't see it like actually shoot out.
I wrote down on my notes, this guy who shot the shark should be a stormtrooper. Because I literally thought it was like a pew! And
that
like
was Nemo.
Whoever it was.
There you go.
He should be a stormtrooper too. But like, he actually hit something. So,
he did. Yeah. His shock.
The shack.
I think this leads though to one of the best scenes in the film. Again, just working on the character work is when our three heroes, I guess we can call them at this point, or they're growing into their heroes.
Yeah.
Even though the professor is kind of sinking.
Yeah.
This is an interesting thing. But you basically learn that, you know, Konso's a coward.
Mm-hmm.
The professor is starting to value discovery over humanity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's hints of it in the beginning, but it's really starting to sink
itself,
in now.
Yeah.
And Ned shows that his values is that he values himself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Overall, and just getting out of there. And I think that, again, this continues what is an unexpectedly well-done character work in this film, because I don't know why. I hadn't seen this for a little while. So maybe I just kind of forgot about it. I mean, when was the last time you actually watched this in full, Ryan?
Actually, I've seen it twice recently, but prior to that, it had to have been at least 3 or 4 years.
Okay. So, this is, I feel like this is the heart of the movie that keeps the story going. Would you agree with that? Do you have like a different view on what keeps
it
going?
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think, because it does become, and even going back and watching it, I was like, oh, it's 2 hours long. Like, where exactly are we filling that space? And there is a lot of this character development piece, and it does take quite a while to go through all the iterations of these characters, and I think that it does tend to drive what's happening.
Yes, Melissa?
Oh, no.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I was going to ask you, Melissa, did the scene of Nemo playing the organ remind you of anything in particular? Disney-related?
Well, I'm totally blanking on his name.
David
Tentacle
Jones.
Guys, yeah.
Yeah, David Jones.
Yeah.
I think that this is definitely a shot that they, an idea that they use 100% when we see Davy Jones at the organ.
Now, did he really play that? Because he looked pretty convincing.
I don't know.
But then he got really sweaty.
Oh, he's sweaty in a lot of this movie.
Yeah.
He's Brock Lesnar sweaty.
Yeah. There's some flop sweats going on in this film. The professor at one point just has to pat his head on screen. And I know that he's supposed to play it up nervous, but yeah, I think we start seeing Nemo crack.
Well, yeah. I love this line that comes up. He says his greatest treasure is a sound mind and full belly. And I just think it's hysterical because I'm like, dude, you don't have a sound mind.
But in his own mind, it's sound.
I know, but it's just funny because it was like, irony.
So the Nautilus, Ryan, am I supposed to take that this is nuclear energy that he has harnessed?
Yeah, so this is where it takes a departure from the book, where in the book it seems more like fuel cells, like almost like a combustion engine. This was because we were less than 10 years after the discovery of nuclear power when the film came out in 1954. That's where they turned with it.
And I think it's a smart exchange, and it makes it something that people who would connect with it more.
Yeah.
You know, that threat of nuclear, and what happens if it gets to the wrong hands.
Yes.
Right.
I guess would really be the biggest nod of it. And we get more concrete of Nemo saying that he's unwilling to share his discoveries with anybody else. Is this where... No, we learned about his family and stuff later on in the film.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Something interesting, an hour into the film, we are told by the narrator, who is the professor, that we have traveled 10,000 leagues under the sea.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
I was just like, wow, okay. We're literally halfway through this film, you're telling us we've traveled... half the distance that this book, pertains to travel, which is under the water. That was, I feel like that was something that was always misinterpreted with this title, was that they're physically 20,000 leagues under the sea, not that they travel 20,000 leagues under the sea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was always something kind of funny.
Definitely people get that confused all the time.
Yep. So, Ryan, do you want to tell us about the prison camp and whatnot? Like, what do we see over there?
So, we get to see... Nemo asks Professor to come ashore, and it's this prison camp where they're taking out phosphorus and the other compounds to make weapons effectively. And you see the slave labor where they're being beaten and chained and to drag these to the ships, to the boats that are going out. And what we find out is that this is where Nemo came from, and this is where his crew have come from, and that's why they're so loyal to him, is that, you know, they have escaped and they will never go back, and this is why they have this, you know, just or unjust view of humanity as truly an evil thing with power in the wrong hands.
So after we learn that Nemo's wife and child were tortured to death because Nemo refused to divulge the secrets of his power, do you find yourself rooting for Nemo?
Kind of do, yeah. I mean, you can kind of understand how he got to this point. You can see how he got to this point. And yeah, I mean, in a way, you kind of do root for him.
I mean, I feel the professor definitely does, because he snaps at God, why can I not say that's
Conceal?
Right? Conceal, he kind of snaps at him.
Yeah.
When Conceal questions, why would you follow him? Because he doesn't tell him, though. He doesn't share the information, because I guess he feels, unless right. Nemo feels personally to tell somebody else, mm-hmm. that's not his job to do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he absolutely goes on the defensive for him. Ryan, are you... Yeah. Are you in Camp Nemo at this point, where you're rooting for him to, you know, to keep everything away from everybody?
I think I'm Camp Conceal the entire time. I'm like, yes, just let this poor man have get out of this situation. but I think it's interesting that, you know, this is Nemo. You definitely, you know, if you know, we're going to describe him as the villain in the film, you definitely become much more sympathetic to his plight at this point, seeing everything he's come through. But you also have this. You know, okay, he's chosen to divulge it to this person. Is that because he trusts this person, or is that because he's playing a game and he's still playing this person against, you know, his friends and seeing what that interaction is? And so it's that continuing that layering of the character stuff that we have.
Scott, towards this dilemma of, you learn now what drives Nemo, does that give you sympathy, or do you still see him as a murderer? Because, I mean, ultimately he's murdering... I guess that's ultimately the question. The people who are on these ships, knowingly transporting from a prison island and bringing tools of destruction, you know, around the world.
Yeah.
Do you see them as victims of Nemo's terror, or do you see Nemo as almost like a violent Batman?
Yeah, no, I'm actually not against Nemo, but it goes back to what Ned had said after they, you know, see the ship, you know, he goes, those people were sailors just like me. You know, they seem like they were just like me.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just like, they're not the ones that are, I mean, they're physically the ones that are bringing these things and, you know, that cause this destruction, but they're kind of just like
doing their job.
Yeah.
You know,
well, and how many of them could be slaves? How many of them could have been the slaves that they put on that they forced to work on that
ship?
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So as I see where, you know, Nemo comes from, it's also the flip side that I see more.
I want to nominate an iconic shot.
Okay.
That happens during this, and that is when the Nautilus is in the foreground to the right of the frame, and we have the sunset in, you know, well, obviously in the sky, and we have a ship passing, that warship or that transport ship going by in the sunset.
Yeah.
I think that is one of my iconic shot nominations. The composition in that shot is absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if it was art enhanced or if they just waited for that perfect moment, but that was also with the models.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that they just set everything up perfectly to get that shot, which I just thought was absolutely gorgeous. This is actually really, I guess, when we first go to the prison island, that's when Nemo really starts going. We have another scene of him on the organ, but he's even more, what's what I'm looking for?
Intense.
Yeah, intense and kind of...
frenzied.
Thank you.
Yeah,
frantic.
Feverish, yeah.
Yeah, feverish and frantic. This is when he's attacking another ship, and I got the impression that this wasn't normally the reaction that he has when ramming a ship.
Yeah.
You know, it was something about trying to... I wonder if the professor's rejection of his justification drives him a little bit further, because he thought that he had a confidant, and he opens up probably more than I would imagine he has to anybody outside of the crew. And he's not really accepted.
Yeah, I wonder if maybe he's in some way starting to question himself, like, you know, the professor, the person is making him, because before he's probably so set to do what he wants, like his mind is set, and now maybe when he's speaking to someone that he considers maybe kind of like an equal intelligence wise, and he's questioning him, you know, maybe it's start making him start to question himself.
Yeah, that's a good point. And then I love the scene where Consul is with the professor and he calls him Captain.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't catch it the first time, and then he turns around and he's like, "What'd you call me?" That was my impression.
Yeah.
That was
good.
And this is what kind of pushes Consul to befriend Ned.
Yep.
Yeah, he kind of like goes
they
out.
They weren't really friends before. No. You know, he was like, Ned's really a bully.
Ned's only friend is really that seal.
It's a good friend, though.
It's a good friend. Yeah. It's a good,
although it does, like, try to bite him in that scene later on.
Friendly.
It's a friendly nibble.
I don't think so.
Friendly nibble.
Can you get killed by a seal?
They're definitely carnivores,
They could probably slap you to death.
That's a good point. That's right. I wanted to kill Paul that way, I remember. We had a really long plan, Ryan, for a friend of ours. We were going to tie him to a chair and have a penguin slap him to death.
Yes,
a
penguin. Yes,
that was just because, you know, why not?
Why not? Yeah. There you go.
I love the little musical cue of Ned pushing his hair. Mm. When he pushes Laurie's hair, it's like that broomp.
Oh.
And then when he hits it, it's like broomp.
I just love when Laurie's like, "You can't send messages in a bottle. That's so Robinson Crusoe." Like,
that is pretty...
No, I've heard a story where it worked.
Yeah. I heard it worked, so it must still be working.
And then it works.
It does. It totally works. Yeah.
That might be the strangest part, is that was his plan. And it was successful.
Yeah.
That's a bit nuts. Of all the things that go on in this film.
That was kind of a stretch.
Because we know now, giant squids exist.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
But messages in a bottle, I don't know.
Yeah,
I guess Sting would say that it works.
I guess.
That's a good Sting reference, huh? Yeah. Okay, so where do we go next over here, Rye? This is when the Nautilus crashes into the reef?
Yeah, this is when they get stuck on the reef and they're trying to get back out. Wait, did we miss the? Yeah, so they go hunting. The Peter Lorre and Ned go hunting on the island.
Yeah,
yeah.
Don't go off the beach.
Yeah, he's pretty. Nemo's really trying to be helpful here.
He really is kind of like, you know.
He softens up a little bit. He lets them off the boat. And he even warns them, like, don't go off the beach. There are cannibals. He doesn't say, don't go off the beach because I don't want you to.
Yeah.
He specifically says, like, no, because there are
things
cannibals
that
are
people that will eat you here. Yes.
You're going to go into the jungle cruise if you go into it.
Yeah, I know. Is 100%. That on purpose, Ryan? I mean, that
it has to be.
It has to be, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
it's so similar. Yeah, like the patterns on the shield,
even the skulls on the stick. And then like the drums. Oh, turn around! The welcoming party's here.
The part that was similar to me is later on when in Pirates.
Oh, with the water.
When Johnny Depp is in that you know, that village, and they think he's like a god.
Uh huh.
And then they find out he's not, and they start chasing him on the beach.
Yep.
As he's running towards the ship, it was like almost. It looked almost shot for shot, like the same exact.
I'll give you another one. Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
When Indy is running from the thing and he's running towards the one guy in the boat, in the plane at that one.
Jock Lindsey.
But yeah, if you look at the series of shots, it's almost one-to-one.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's kind of cool.
That's awesome.
So I just, somewhere in my mind.
If it works, you keep using it.
Yeah, exactly. So much of film is simply like, I found other films that were done really well, and I'm just going to mishmash it enough that hopefully no one notices.
Yeah.
It works out really well. I'm sorry, Ryan, were you about to say something?
No, I was just thinking about the natives. The great details that get hidden because of, you know, back then cameras weren't quite zoomed in on everyone. And that they were writing things, like the people who play the natives were writing things on their face with like grease pins. Like there was one guy that says "Eat at Joe's" on his face, and then the guy behind him says "I ate Joe," but it never appears on screen because they're running by and the cameras weren't sensitive enough to catch it.
Oh,
yeah, I had read that and I was looking for it and I didn't see it. So now, okay, so it is after. It is, they are there though.
They are there, yeah. There's a bunch of stuff. I think some of the DVDs have some behind the scenes stuff, and I don't know that it shows that one in particular, but it shows them writing things on their face that they know no one's ever going to see.
Oh, it's great. I really hope. We're still waiting for a Blu-ray.
Yeah.
Yeah. No.
On this thing. I mean, it's available in high def on iTunes.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that's remastered. I don't know if they would just like put it in a higher resolution, boys.
Yeah. I don't think it's remastered.
I don't think so.
No.
Because I watched on the DVD today, and my brain was like, "Technology's changed."
Yeah. I watched it on. I had taped it from the whatever.
Yeah.
The
Turner
Classic
Music.
TCM. Yeah.
I deleted it, and Melissa got so mad at me. And I said, "But we own it." She's like, "Yeah, but we had it recorded." I was like, "But we own it."
Yes, I didn't own it, so that's why I left it, because I didn't own it.
I had the DVD, and I still was like, I'm going to download the iTunes and watch it that way just to see if there's a difference when I watch it this time.
How did it look? Because I was kind of tempted. It's $18 to buy it.
Yeah, so I rented it. I just did like the $4. Like, let's rent it and just see. It looks cleaner, but I don't think it's been remastered. Like, I think it's just, you know, okay, yeah, we're going to high-res it up and send it out there.
All right, so I'll hold off a little bit longer.
Yeah.
Oh, man, it's so tempting, though, just because DVD menu comes up, and I'm like, archaic nonsense.
No, that's crazy.
Like, what is this? Okay, so they get back to the ship. They're being chased by the – I love this entire sequence so much.
Yeah.
Because how cool does Nemo look in this scene? Like, wearing the turtleneck, and they just run on board, and he's like
–
He's just so cool. He's like – They'll come. Don't worry.
Yeah.
And you know, he's just sitting there waiting. Oh, God. I just thought of this. You know what? The captain of the boat in Raiders of the Lost Ark is wearing his exact outfit, I think, that he's wearing in this scene. The black captain.
The turtleneck with the white long sleeve ribbed. Yeah.
Yeah. He's like wearing almost the same exact outfit. But he just looked so cool. I thought this was Nemo at his coolest.
Yeah, he definitely.
And again, he seems to be lightening up a little bit towards Ned, but then no. But I was a big fan of the electric parade that they put on.
That didn't hold up as well, but it was still funny. Yeah, it was still funny to see, though.
Old electric animation looks like old electric animation.
It definitely does. There's no way to make that look good.
There's not much ways around that. But now this is done. Like, Ned has finally crossed the line, and he's going to throw him into the... I don't know. Is he going to kill him, Ryan? Do you think that he makes a decision now, like, I'm going to just abandon you and kill you?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what's going to happen.
That's not good. That's hurting my hero praise of Nemo. Then again, though, Ned does repeatedly. What was his plan?
He was going to escape. So, yeah, like, Nemo called it. Like, you were going to...
To where?
The sea?
The other side of the island?
Yeah, I don't. I have no idea.
He's going to go to Neverland.
That's what's on the other side of Neverland.
Because
I thought it was rum on the other side of that island, and that's
Yeah, I thought of that. I was like, sea turtles, mate.
Yeah.
That's how he's going to get out. He's going to rope sea turtles, and that'll be how we get there. But then something basically halts everything because we see warships are now surrounding Vulcania. And the Nautilus actually suffers some major damage from a shell strike, and they're taking on water and everything. And to escape the damage, they have to go down. And this is where we get our battle with the actual squid.
Yeah.
Which is the monster encountering the monster.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I love this sequence so much.
I could not believe that this sequence was from 1954. Yeah. I was really amazed that it still looked as good as it did. And yeah, I love this. Is my favorite. I mean, this was my favorite part as a kid, obviously. But
yeah,
I mean, this still is. It still held up for me.
Does it hold up for you, Ryan?
Yeah, it holds up. I mean, you know, if you're it just holds up. I mean, you have the beak and it's snapping, and you know, the way they've set the tentacles around, you know, when they grab the crew members.
Yeah,
it holds up. It holds up remarkably well.
The only thing that I noticed as a negative was, were there a couple of parts that were sped up?
Oh, I didn't notice.
I did notice that on the DVD, but I didn't know if that was a weird thing on the DVD.
Oh,
but
I don't
then
know.
The sound would have been out of sync.
Yeah, the sound would have been out of sync.
Just a couple of shots when, in particular, Nemo is like crawling on the ship and whatnot. He's, you know, grabbing onto the ship, where it seems a step faster, a little bit Charlie Chaplin-esque.
Oh, I didn't notice it, but I'll have to go back and look.
So I think this works out. Yeah, I love the beak. The beak looks
creepy and terrifying.
And the one guy gets killed by the tentacles and whatnot. But now Scott and Melissa, this movie, this it didn't flow for you as well. Were you, Scott, already kind of on the edge of, oh, I don't know, this is like taking too long to get to it?
This is when I woke up.
Oh my god!
Not gonna lie.
when did you conk out?
It was right after the Cannibal Island scene.
Okay, you were only asleep for like 5 minutes.
Yeah, but it was still 5 minutes.
Okay.
No, but this scene was really good.
Yeah, you think it still holds? I mean, given what it is for when it was made.
Yeah. No, of course. I think it's it's a really good scene, and it's probably the only scene that I was actually like there was actually action in that I felt.
Okay, Melissa?
Yeah, no, I felt like the drama was still, like, you were still, like, anticipating, like, what was going to happen. The monster still looked threatening. There was still, you know, tension. So I thought it was really, like, very, it did what it had to do, and it still does it.
And Ned saves Nemo.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's ultimately how it ends. And I thought James Mason looks legitimately dead when they're dragging him, like, he's swimming with him back to the ship.
Yeah.
At first, I thought it was a dummy that he was swimming with, and it's not. He just looks really bad. Like, he looks like he is in bad shape. The lighting and everything hiding his face and him getting hit by the water.
Yeah.
He just looks like, this man is going to die.
Yeah.
But
this man is dead.
This man is dead. Nice. Wow. History of the World reference. My God, woman.
I got it.
Well done. So now, we're basically starting to wrap up. And Nemo's plan is really kind of going to come to a head now. They are surrounded now by warships as they approach the island of Vulcania. And a small little detail that was really well thought out. Remember that big map that Ned and Consul look at? And they're trying to figure out like where they're headed and whatnot?
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the map when they get to Vulcania, that big mechanical arm is actually at the center of the map now.
Mm-hmm.
As if, like, some, Nemo has been actually plotting out the course, and they move it respectively correctly throughout the film.
Oh, that's great.
It's a
good little detail, that...
Yeah, a nice little detail.
Yeah.
I do like that Nemo is still not won over, though, by Ned over his act of heroism.
I know he regrets it.
Yeah, Ryan, how did you like how this added on to the character of Nemo? I mean, even with Ned sacrificing himself to save him when he has no reason to, when questioned about it in private, he basically says, well, it's only a single act.
Right, and he probably wouldn't do it again because I would certainly not save his life. And so he just kind of brushes it off.
Yeah, and I thought that was really – I think it's strong because there's an easier path to making this character really, really sympathetic. – Mm-hmm. And this would have been one of the moments, like, now he's going to find the goodness in folks. Mm-hmm. But no, that's not Nemo. Like, that's not what happens.
No.
And I think that makes his character extremely strong.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely.
And
it
doesn't fall into, what's what I'm looking for?
The easy way out. Yeah, it doesn't.
Yeah, the easy way out thing. I was so curious to see what the inside of that base looked like, though.
Yeah, I would have loved to have seen that.
He just runs in and runs out.
Yeah, I know.
Like, son of a bitch.
It's like, come on, man. At least like 2 minutes in there or something.
Actually, Ryan, what's a park that has the Jules Verne?
Disney Sea.
Yeah.
Is there anything? Is that supposed to be Vulcania?
Yeah.
Oh, good lord.
There's a 20,000 Leagues Dark Ride.
I want to go.
I know. I watched video of it.
You did? You're not supposed to do that?
Well, no, it was from the Disney site. It's from the Disney site. It was like 30, 40 seconds.
Oh, okay.
There's also like a Nautilus galley, but the menus were all in Japanese.
Fine. Order me. I want to go to a Disney park and have no idea what anything's being said. There's just, I want to know if story is so well told that I don't need someone to literally tell me it.
Yeah.
I cannot wait to do that. Have you ever been, Ryan?
No. It's one of those bucket list things. Like, I'll get there someday. Kind of like Shanghai has all of a sudden popped up on that list. Like, I'll get there someday.
Well, we got to go to Tokyo after 2020 because that's after, Big Hero 6 and Beauty and the Beast editions will be in there.
Yeah.
So we'll plan a group trip, right?
I think
there you go.
I honestly think we should definitely look at that because we also should do both parks.
Yeah. Because we're over there.
The flight is going to be so expensive enough that you may as well just try to hit up both.
Just live there.
Just no. No, I'm fine on that one. I think it's humid in Florida.
Yeah.
So, Nemo gets shot while going back.
I love this, though, because I wrote it down. Like, really? This one time? Like, he's almost there after all these random gunshots all the time. He's rowing the ship back to the... This is when he gets him.
You also probably don't think Oswald killed JFK, I'm assuming?
Ah.
I don't believe it. So, but yes, the one shot finally hits him. Out of the plethora of shots. I can't believe that this was the part that you found most unbelievable.
This is what I do, though. I find, like, the one thing where I'm like, come on.
Yeah, come what's your favorite movie? Ever After with Drew Barrymore?
It's a good movie.
All right. Yeah, we'll discuss that later.
It's a fairy tale.
It's a tale, all right. Okay. So Nemo gets shot mortally. Mortally wounded. He knows it.
Yep.
And him and his crew are okay with scuttling the ship, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Like, setting the ship onto auto-destruct, like Khan.
Yeah.
Like Khan.
Yep.
Yeah.
And he's going to take everyone down with him, though.
Yeah, whether they want to or not. They're all going.
Yeah.
Yep.
I think the only people who don't want to are the Professor, Ned, and Khan.
Yeah, it's just
everyone else is like, yep, nope, we're good with this.
Well, that's what I was getting to earlier, where he wanted to see, I think... the professor, because his crew would go down with him.
Yeah.
He knew that. Yeah. So he wanted to see if he would go down with those people. And, you know, Ned has other plans.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Ned's always got other plans.
Yeah.
Brian, does this sour you on Nemo? I mean, or, you know, how it's hard to root for the man at this point, isn't it?
Well, he's dying. So it's not necessarily hard to root for him. he's goner one way or the other. So, it kind of makes you question the sanity of everyone else in that crew, because they're all just standing there waiting in the room like, all right, yep, this is where we all go.
Yeah.
Very cult-like.
It's a cult.
Yep.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's very cult. Very Jim Jones-ish.
Yeah.
Where, wow, I mean, if you've ever heard the videotapes of that stuff.
Yeah.
Woof. That is an experience that I think everyone should experience, because it's incredible. So, yeah. So, basically, he's going to go down with the ship, and the other boys... They're like, no.
Yeah, this is not part of the plan.
Which is a very large diversion from the book. Now, in the book, a typhoon basically gets the Nautilus gets caught in like a water typhoon, and it gets pulled under, and you assume that Nemo dies, but he doesn't.
Right.
And that's where the book Fantastic Voyage,
Mysterious Island.
Thank you.
Fantastic. You're thinking of a Coolio song.
Coolio? Yeah. And that's where Mysterious Island comes in, which, if you've ever seen, there's a phenomenal Mysterious Island film that features a lot of Ray Harryhausen stop animation.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, you've never seen
it? No, I've never seen that.
With the big bees?
No.
Oh, it's so great. They cook a giant crab.
Oh, my gosh.
It's something. And it has to do with the Civil War and air balloons. It's just great. And you find Nemo. You know, Nemo is still there. And that's basically where he goes from Volcano. He's like... I shall no longer make ships. I shall make giant versions of animals because why not?
Yeah.
We have the technology.
It was the radiation, right?
The technology to bring him
back. Yeah, Godzilla comes from this.
Yeah.
There's a Godzilla versus King Kong movie coming out?
Yeah.
What?
Why?
All of the seven hells.
I don't know.
No, seven seas.
Whatever.
Theming.
Seven seas of Ryan?
Yeah.
So, Ryan... you know, our film basically wraps up. Nemo dies looking at the sea, which I think is so great.
Yeah.
You know, his final action is to open that port window so he can see the blue of the ocean just before he dies. Do you, you know, are you satisfied with this ending? Do you think it comes to a good conclusion?
I think it sells Disney short on making the sequel of Mysterious Island.
Yeah.
You know, we have this the nuclear explosion on the island. We have the sub going under, you know, and you have Nemo's words kind of floating out there, and it ties together nicely.
Yeah, Melissa, actually, did you write down those words? I remember you said you really loved that last quote.
I did really love it, but I didn't write it down.
That's okay.
There is hope for the future. And when the world is ready for a new, better life, all this will someday come to pass. In God's good time.
I just love it because, you know, it's like at the very end, it's like in all God's timing. Like, it'll happen when it's supposed to happen. Like, this technology, if it's meant to be out there, if man's ready for it, you know, which was always his thing. Like, he always felt like man wasn't ready for it because, like you said, he felt man would just weaponize it, you know? Yeah. So it wouldn't be this wonderful tool that he has. It would be a weapon in anybody else's hand. So until they can learn that lesson, until they could differentiate, it's not going to come to light. And then, like, the ship goes down with that, you know?
I would argue this is the best character that Disney has created thus far, has portrayed. They didn't create him. In the films that we'd watched so far, the animated films or whatnot, maybe having a live-action actor, you know, adds to that. A two-hour film.
Yeah.
Right.
You can obviously develop the character much, much more. They also could have dropped the ball completely.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely.
You know, yeah. Nothing is a guaranteed success. So, you know, Brian, did you enjoy the climax of this film, the way that it goes?
I did. I like the way it ended. I like you said, the same type of thing. I love that the shot with him opening up the porthole to see the ocean, and just that, you know, he went out still with, you know, I think
fire.
Yeah, like still believing that his way was the right way. You know, and I liked it. I think his like you said, his character, I agree. I think it's probably their best. And we just talked about it on Peter Pan. So this is two movies in a row where they had probably their two best characters in terms of Hook. Yeah. Hook and Nemo in terms of complexity and just they're kind of bad guys, but you kind of like them.
Yeah.
And you can kind of sympathize with them. And that's a really hard thing to pull off. And, you know, they did it, and it was good.
So you guys want to go into our three questions?
Yes.
Yep.
Okay. So for anyone who's new and whatnot, I guess I should have said at the top of the show, but I always forget. Yeah. Melissa, actually, why don't you say, what are the three questions that we always go towards we ask a film?
We're going to ask if it's a moral film or an emotional film. Does it give us a lesson, or does it evoke just an emotional response, or does it do both or neither? We'll ask what the iconic shot is, which I'm wonderful at.
Oh, God. Ryan, have you listened recently to this woman and what she does every time?
I've been traveling too much to catch the past couple.
She is doing nothing but naming entire scenes of films. Like, not shots. She wants, like, 25 minutes of film.
No.
Well, I think that – but I think in this film, I think, like, what I was reading was the average shot was, like, 9 seconds. So you only have 9 seconds to pull there.
I can think of some with this. I think I'm good with this one.
All right.
And then our final question is, does it still hold up?
Okay. Well, let's start with the – what is the – is this a morals-driven film, or is it trying to garner an emotion from you? Does it do both? Does it do neither? You know, is it successful at it? Ryan, why don't you start us off on that?
I mean, I think considering the source material, there's definitely a moral to it. But I think it's also one of those things where you can kind of pick your moral to it. Is it, you know, man is its own destroyer? Is it that, you know, we should only trust, you know, those who we can – with our own technology that have passed through our tests. There's all those different morals you can kind of find if you really want to look for it. But I think it is more of a moral tale than trying to elicit an emotional response.
Brian?
I agree with Ryan. It's definitely a moral tale. And it's kind of – it's a moral tale where you can pick your moral, I feel, out of it. That you can, you know, like, you know, man – sometimes there's too much power for man and they're not ready for it. Or – you know, you have to, if you don't believe in humanity, you can turn into Nemo. You know, that's the type of person you can become.
Okay.
So I think it walks that line. It's definitely a morality story, but you can kind of, this gives you both sides of it.
Okay. Melissa.
Yeah. And actually just hearing everybody's, you know, answers, it kind of reminds me of like Civil War. Like there's two sides to this argument, you know, is man just inherently evil that every technology he'll get his hands on will be a weapon, or, you know, can it be entrusted to him? I kind of feel like it's that same, you know, idea. Do you side with Nemo and just say, nope, man can't be trusted? Or do you side with the professor and say, no, this is like new stuff. People should be exposed to it.
Their relationship could even be drawn a very direct line for Magneto and Charles.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Actually, you know, even toward, you know, it's maybe a little closer towards the Nemo character for Magneto.
Yeah.
Nemo character from Magneto. I said that wrong, didn't I?
Yeah, because Magneto always thinks just men are just going to be evil. And that's
usually right.
Yeah, and Nemo's been proven that a bunch of times, you know, from when he was a slave to when his wife and child, you know, died. I mean, yeah. I think he's been shown that, no, you can't give them a chance.
Yeah. And not, I mean,
yeah,
like,
you know what, that's...
Not I, even died, tortured. Like, they use the word tortured.
Tortured, yeah.
Which is a pretty harsh word to throw in, like, a family Disney, you know, our big first, you know, release on our own. That's a, again, I think that's a pretty gutsy move to throw that word out there.
Yeah, it is.
Scott, what do you feel?
I feel it's kind of both. Going what everybody was saying about the moral of the film, you could take from it what you will. But also a couple of lines, like when Nemo asks the professor, like, do you know what love is?
Mm.
And he says, like, I'm pretty sure I do. Oh. No. And then, you know, Nemo says, well, you know, anger or hate, you know, hate can fill your heart just as quickly. You know, and I feel like an emotion sense of it is, you know, sometimes it's your emotions get the better of you. Like we were saying before, where he kind of contemplates whether he was doing the right thing when he takes down that first warship, you know, and you know, you got to kind of keep your emotions in check.
I would agree. Actually, I agree with you, Scott. I think that it does hit both. And yeah, I 100% agree with what Ryan said initially. I think that the moral of the film is it can be on multiple levels. But I think that, you know, does should man inherit the sun sort of idea is very, very heavy in the film. But I think that they go to very strong lengths in the screenplay to try to play your emotions as in who are you going to root for? Mm-hmm. Who do you agree with? Do you agree with Ned? Is it just the way that it is? Do you agree with, you know, Consul? Do you agree with Nemo? Yeah. You know, who is the guy that if they're put in front of you and you have a choice of who you have to follow, which direction are you going to go in?
Mm-hmm.
Or are you the professor where you wrestle with that idea through the entire, like the professor is us.
Yeah. The professor is the one.
Which is great. You know,
exactly. He's the one that is playing all three of these sides and trying to balance them. Whereas each these other characters are, they have their ways and that's the way, you know, there's not, I mean, like we said, I think Nemo at times maybe wavers a little bit.
Yeah.
Like you can think that, but we're supposed to be the professor in this.
Let's go now to the iconic shot of the film. Ryan, what would you say for that?
I really want to argue for the squid. I really want to have that fight sequence, but it's the, you know, when it's plying through the water, full charge, you have the glowing eyes, like that's the shot.
All right. Melissa, let's go over to you.
That's a good shot.
Just God help me.
I also like the squid. That's my second runner-up. But I really liked the very last shot of Nemo with his hand on the lever opening, you know, the porthole. So it's just that still of, like, the blue ocean, his hand on the lever.
She said the word still.
She said the word still.
Oh, my God.
I did it.
Yeah, she did it. You're learning. She can learn.
Hercules.
It won't happen next week.
No, probably not. No, that's great. Scott.
Mine's actually the first time you see the Nautilus underwater, the full shot of the ship.
Okay, of it traveling under the water.
Yep,
I gotcha. Brian,
I'll save you, Ryan, and I'm gonna say the squid. Just
there you go.
You know, the squid just
which one
attached to the boat and the arms just, you know, it just
when they're above the water or below the water.
No, below.
Because, like, you have the squid at the back. No, because I have a very specific shot in my head also. Or, like, the squid where he comes back the second time after he's been electrocuted. He's like, nah, I'm good.
No, after he comes back
he
the
goes
second
on top.
Time.
And then, rah. Yeah. Good job.
All right. I have... mine is the one I said before, actually. It is the Nautilus
sunset.
With the sunset and the ship traveling. Mm-hmm. If I could print that and put that on my wall, I would... But we have no wall space, so it's a multi.
In a few weeks, you will.
No, not really.
Oh no!
There's so much stuff behind storage.
I have 9 Mondo posters sized at 24x36.
Oh wow!
Yeah,
that are not hung up.
Put them on the ceiling.
None of them are on the walls.
Yeah, no, I was just gigs. Yeah.
Yeah. So no, those walls are done even before we even move in. And finally. Does this film hold up? I'm actually going to start with the two people who didn't enjoy the film as much or just didn't. Melissa, let's go to you first.
No, I think it still holds up. I just, like I said, I didn't have like an emotional connection to it. So like, you know, like when you see a Nautilus thing, like you're like, oh, like to me, I probably still wouldn't get that way, but it was good. I liked it. You know, it just was, it was like, I could see why Scott fell asleep. I probably could have also.
Okay, Scott.
I don't think it's the hold up.
Okay.
Only because of the time that it was made. I mean, it would have to be a completely different technology that they have. I mean, I guess in the grand scheme of it, it could still work. But as it is now, the movie, you know what I mean? I don't think it would still keep an audience's attention.
Okay. Brian?
I think it still holds up, especially for adults. Maybe not so much for kids. I can see kids struggling with it and falling off it because, it's, one, it's a long movie, and, two, there's not a lot of action at times. It's very dialogue-heavy. Mm-hmm. So that's why, that's one of the reasons why I think it holds up. Some of the – a lot of the scenes actually still hold up, but some of them, like we talked about the electrocution and there was another scene I can't remember right now, but they're a little shaky. But being that it's such a character-driven and dialogue-heavy movie, I think it still holds up. And it's good. It's well-acted. The dialogue is great. The characters are compelling. I definitely think it holds up.
I have a feeling that I can just let Ryan speak for me, so I'm going to let Ryan speak for me. Do you think that this film holds up, Ryan?
I do. I think Brian hit a lot of it there with talking about the dialogue, the characters. You have it's story-driven. It's not effects-driven. The effects kind of supplement it. But I think going back to what we were talking about earlier, where this is what we think of when we think of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. This is the standard bearer that we hold it. Anything that's going to come after it as an iteration. That to me, that says, yeah, it holds up.
Couldn't have said it better myself. And the only thing the Mason performance as Nemo is, yeah. I think, one of the iconic performances in film. I really do. Mm-hmm. And the visuals are still ones that elicit a response, and they're ones that still they inspire filmmaking now.
Mm. Yeah,
It's one of those films that's still inspiring filmmaking now, and art now.
Yeah, and that's in the steampunk vibe. That sort of thing came from there.
So for me, it is. It's one of my favorite Disney films as well. It's definitely my top five Disney films. If I had to put a hard list to it and think about it, it would absolutely be in my top five. So. So that is our look back at the 1954 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Please make a new attraction.
Yeah.
I think it would fit. I think it would be fine.
Oh, it would. I think so too. But
I don't know. Where would you put that? Ryan, where would you put a new 20,000 Leagues attraction if you could?
Studios. Mm. Just to talk about the filmmaking aspect of it, just to get some history behind it.
Yeah.
I think that's where it would have to go at this point.
That would be fine. That would be great.
Yeah, no, definitely.
What if it was almost like a multi-parted, making of thing where you experience different scenes of the film?
Yeah, almost kind of like they did with the Backlot Tour type of thing.
Yeah, could
but
you
like
do that,
through
you
that,
think?
I think so.
Or you could even do it at this, just to use a Mysterious Island piece, but use the Nautilus as your exploring piece for it, and go over to Animal Kingdom, and then now we have Mysterious Island to go explore.
Ooh!
Oh my God.
I'm all about Animal Kingdom.
Call up Disney right now.
Get what's his name on the phone? Rhodey.
Yeah, get Rhodey on the phone.
I got to find that man.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to go full Tommy, Harrison Ford when we get down there in a couple of weeks. Yeah. You find that man! Waving fingers in people's faces, everything.
He's walking around that park probably a lot.
At least he sticks out at least. It won't be hard to find him.
It's not hard to pick to miss him.
So I want to thank you so much, Ryan, for coming back on the show again with us this week.
Not a problem, anytime.
And I believe we're going to see you next week for Davy Crockett.
I think so.
Huzzah.
Do we get to sing?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, yeah.
Okay. Ryan said it. He's going to.
Okay.
I heard it.
Well, I mean, yeah. Then yes, we're going to sing.
Okay, I'm happy.
Are you going to sing?
Maybe.
All right. You have to sing if anyone's going
to sing. Yeah, if you want, you have to sing.
I don't believe we had any new reviews, though, this week, right?
No,
none this week.
First week for a long, 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 long time. But oh well. No reviews this week, so no one gets any candy. If you ever want to, I think you should. So right now, you are listening to No Worries. You can find this video and more over at youtube.com/pogo, his music at soundcloud.com/pogomix, and his website is pogomix.net. And if you want, we just had him, Pogo, on the show last week's episode of The Film Basement, if you want to head over and check that out. We are LastGenPodcast.com. Find us on Twitter at Diz, D-I-S, Magic Hour Pod. On Facebook, if you search for Disney Magic Hour, you will find our group. And then, of course, if you head on over to iTunes, give a 5-star review, we will read it live on the air. On Google Music, if you head into the podcast section and look for Disney Magic Hour, you shall find us. And SoundCloud is the home of all of our audio now. And you can find that at soundcloud.com/Disney Magic Hour Podcast. Ryan, where can everyone find you on the net?
MainSTGazette.com for the blog. MainSTGazette everywhere else.
Huzzah. I really, so much cleaner. So jealous. So much better done. Till next week, which, as I said, we will be looking at Davy Crockett and then going over whatever news pops up, as I think is going to be our norm from now on.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
I really enjoy doing that. Say goodnight, Melissa.
Goodnight, Melissa.
Say goodnight, Scott.
Goodnight, Scott.
Say goodnight, Brian.
Goodnight, Brian.
Say goodnight, Ryan.
Goodnight, Ryan.
Goodnight, Pete. And say goodnight, Pogo. Very good.